Hello and welcome to The Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. Next month, after 8 years as the nation's top judge, Robert French, the Chief Justice of the High Court of Australia, will retire. In his first media interview since 2013, the Chief Justice speaks to The Law Report. In a wide-ranging conversation, Robert French reflects on his time at the High Court. We speak about whether judges should ever respond to criticism from politicians and how judges on the court sometimes work together on joint decisions. And we also speak about his long and varied career, the one that led up to his appointment as Chief Justice of the High Court, a role that over the last 8 years he's thoroughly enjoyed.
Yes, it's been a profoundly satisfying and engaging role. The problems that come before the court are all difficult and, for the most part, interesting problems, which involve the court making choices about future directions in the law as well as the current state of the law.
There was a sense some years ago that when it came to power tussles between Canberra and the states, the High Court was very much on Canberra's side. But one of the discernible trends during your time as Chief Justice has been the court strengthening checks and balances on federal and executive powers. And I'm wondering, you're from WA. Does being from WA inform your views about the importance of the Federation?
I think the circumstances which have led to the court recently making decisions of significance to the federal-state relationship is a function of the cases that come before the court, rather than the court or individual judges on the court saying, I'm going to change the direction of the court. So, for example, we had the Pape case in 2009, which looked at the executive power to spend money in the context of the global financial crisis and to send checks out to various people so that they would go off and stimulate the economy by buying things. And although Mr. Pape lost the case, we upheld the validity of the tax bonus legislation. There was an important decision there about the need for something other than a mere appropriation to support the validity of executive spending. And that decision then fed into the later two cases, Williams number one and Williams number two, which are again about federal executive spending power. And
Chaplains in schools.
That was about chaplains in schools, of course. But in the end, it was the important focus of it was not about the policy question. We weren't concerned about that, of course. We were concerned about the checks and balances, if you like, the constraints on executive spending power. And that opened up the larger question of the power of the executive. Now, the constraints on executive spending power had to do, in one sense, with the federal-state relationships, and that was adverted to in some of the judgment because it had to do partly with the role of the Senate.
In that school chaplains case, which involved the Commonwealth funding of chaplains, you commenced your reasons with a quote from one of the architects of the Australian Constitution, Andrew Inglis Clark, and he talked about what federal government means, and he said, quote, "Its essential and distinctive feature is the preservation of the separate existence and corporate life of each of the component states of the Commonwealth." So obviously it looms large in your thinking, that living idea of the Federation.
Well, it should loom large in everybody's thinking, really. We have a federal constitution that brings questions to the High Court from time to time about the distribution of powers and the limits of powers of the various parts of the Federation, the Commonwealth and the states, and of course the territories. And the notion that one level of government, the Commonwealth, can't, as it were, destroy another level of government in the states has been around for a very, very long time.
You're only the third judge of the High Court from WA. I'm wondering, does the thinking about these issues, is it sometimes reflected by where people come from? Do you think that some people from some parts of the country will have a heightened sense of these issues than, say, people from Sydney or Melbourne?
Look, I've never had a sense that, speaking personally, that my view of the Constitution or the distribution of powers is informed by where I come from. And I think you'll find people around Australia who have perhaps differing views about where the extent to which you should adopt a what some people might call a centralist interpretation or as against a state's rights interpretation. Now, who knows what happens in the recesses of the unconscious based upon your life experiences growing up in a particular part of Australia. For my part, a lot of my professional career from the time that I joined the federal court involved me moving around all parts of Australia. And I enjoyed equally the large capitals and regional Australia. And you get, I hope, through that a sort of balanced view, but you see the country as a whole rather than apart from the state that you come from.
There is a long history of Australian politicians criticising judges. We can think back to the Mabo and the Wick decisions of the 1990s. But in 2011, during your time as Chief Justice, the High Court ruled against the ALP government's Malaysia solution. And Prime Minister Julia Gillard accused the court of missing an opportunity to send a message to asylum seekers. She said the court's decision, quote, basically turns on its head the understanding of the law in this country, end quote. And she added that some commentators are saying, quote, that they find the decision incomprehensible, beyond understanding, end quote. And referring to you specifically, she said, His Honour considered comparable legal questions when he was a judge of the federal court and made different decisions to the one that the High Court made yesterday, end quote. What's your response to that kind of comment? What goes through the mind of a judge when those sorts of criticisms are made?
The first thing is no response. Generally speaking, it is a very bad idea for judges who have been criticised to engage in some sort of public debate with the critic. There are, in fact, plenty of protagonists on either side of the debate out in the community, and there were certainly at that time, there were responses to what the Prime Minister said. There were people who were defending her criticism. There were others who were attacking it. For the court to get dragged into that sort of exchange just, I think, is a bad look. So my personal position has been not to respond to such criticism, and I think that's the position of most judges.
Can I put the question slightly differently? When these comments are made, do judges feel under pressure from politicians?
Well, of course, it's human nature, perhaps, for people to not enjoy criticism. On the other hand, if you don't have the capacity to, as it were, shrug off that kind of criticism and just say, this, it's like the weather, you know, it goes with the territory every now and again. It doesn't happen very often, fortunately. It goes with the territory and just get on with the job, then you really shouldn't be in judicial office. You should not feel pressured by what external critics say, because there will always be external critics. That goes with being a public figure, putting out reasons into the public arena, justifying your decisions. And those reasons are properly open to scrutiny and comment in the public sphere.
There was one quote. Parliamentary Secretary David Bradbury said, High Court judges don't have to take telephone calls about boats crashing into rocks on Christmas Island. And I'm wondering, when you hear something like that, what is going through your mind?
One appreciates the position of the minister or the public official who has to deal with the, as it were, on-the-ground realities of the implementation of particular policies, or the frustration of particular policies as they would see it by a decision on the part of the court. But the court's role is to interpret and apply the law as best it can. Now, there are always choices to be made, especially when you're at the cutting edge of interpretation, whether it's the constitution or statutes or the development of the common law. But in the end, you approach those choices by using established principles and having heard all the arguments. And you know that there may be political consequences to particular decisions, or that they may be frustrating to politicians or administrators in some cases. But in the end, that's not a criterion for decision.
One of the threads going through your career is a commitment and an engagement with Indigenous issues. And indeed, you were one of the people who founded the Aboriginal Legal Aid Service in WA. I think at university you set up a committee to provide part-time pro bono advice to those on remand. Going back to that time, what were the unmet legal needs that you were addressing?
Well, I think, first of all, there was simply underrepresentation. There were a lot of Aboriginal people who were being dealt with in courts and by justices of the peace who were unrepresented. And that itself had an impact on what happened to them in terms of conviction rates and imprisonment and so forth. There was a sense that there was a huge amount to be done there in terms of just delivering access to justice.
Now, you were a partner at a law firm for many years. You then became a barrister and you were then appointed a judge of the federal court. You went on to be the president of the Native Title Tribunal for almost 5 years. Earlier this year, you gave the annual State of the Judicature speech, and you spoke about the national disgrace of Indigenous incarceration. A quote, appallingly high rate of Indigenous incarceration, at least 16 times higher than for non-Indigenous Australians. End quote. You said you were sure of one thing, mandatory minimum sentences are not the answer. Can you elaborate? What is the answer to this national tragedy?
I said what is not the answer. That doesn't mean that I know what is the answer. The fact is, as we all know, this is a multidimensional problem and plainly requires a multifaceted response. Another big issue, of course, has been the engagement of the Indigenous leadership and Indigenous communities themselves. And then there are these underlying, it seems from a distance, and really from my perspective, a layman's perspective, the underlying problems of underemployment, move to the margin of urban societies and regional towns, and the sorts of criminal behaviour issues that arise out of that. On the other hand, there are many good stories, and that has to be recognised, that when we address these problems, that there are success stories as well that must be told, because otherwise you give into despair and say nothing can be done. It's all going to get worse. But that's why I think the good stories have to be told as well as the others.
For somebody on the bench, though, you're applying the law as it is. How does somebody with your commitment or another judge with a similar commitment approach issues around Indigenous incarceration, Indigenous imprisonment?
Well, we recognise, first of all, that what we are doing, let's suppose you're a sentencing judge or you're a court reviewing a sentence. Perhaps it's been imposed under some sort of mandatory minimum sentencing regime. What you are doing is at the end of the road, in the sense that the problems which have led to the situation with which the court is confronted arose long before the people came to court. Court is an end stage. You may find that the law gives you very few choices. It depends upon what range of options are there. One of the difficulties with mandatory minimum sentencing, of course, is that it means that different cases may all have to be treated the same, and there can be a kind of injustice in that. On the other hand, we know that for a long time there have been mandatory minimum sentences, things like murder, for example, and other offences. And so there's a policy choice to be made by legislators between emphasising some social value or dealing with some urgent social problem and achieving certainty in outcome on the one hand, and on the other hand, if it's a one-size-fits-all option, generating injustice. Now, the courts and the legal profession and others who are involved with these processes are able to point to those sorts of injustices, but where the court can say this is an unfair result, and sometimes judges do, but their duty is, of course, to impose the sentence which is required by law. They may say, I impose this sentence, and occasionally may say, I believe I should be given more flexible options. I mean, they can't do that every time, but ultimately their duty is to apply the law of the land as the Parliament has enacted it.
I'm not expecting an answer specific to the case, but back in 2001, you were one of the majority on the full court of the federal court, which said that the Howard government could turn the Tampa around, away from Australian waters. And Murray Wilcox, a former federal court judge, said something along the lines of, I suspect Robert French maybe would have found it hard to reach that decision, but he understood what the law was and felt this was his understanding of what the law was. And that's the job of a judge, isn't it? To apply the law as you see it.
Well, that's right. There are people who may disagree with your interpretation of the law, but in the end, you have choices, as I said, and sometimes there are issues of legal policy principles that may inform those choices. But in terms of the kinds of arguments that swirl around asylum seeker policy and so forth. It's not for the judge to get into those debates. The judge has to look at what the law is according to their own view of it. Now, people may disagree with its rightness, and of course there has been a lot of comment and controversy concerning the decision in that case. But that tends to be controversy about the legal issues. And as I say, as a judge, you form your best view of what those legal issues are. And sometimes you may put in a disclaimer and say, look, I am not concerned. I want to make it clear I'm not concerned about the policy, the rights and wrongs in this matter. I have to apply the law as it is so that people understand what you're doing.
You're listening to The Law Report on radio or via a podcast available from the RN website or from iTunes. Today, a conversation with Robert French, the Chief Justice of the High Court of Australia, who's retiring next month. There are seven judges on the High Court, and there are a range of views about whether or not there is value in each judge giving a separate set of reasons in each case. What's your view about that?
Well, each judge is independent of the others in a formal sense. On the other hand, we are a national institution of government. There is plainly a very important place for joint judgments, which will authoritatively and clearly state the law, or joint majority judgments. Now, that doesn't mean that it's wrong or inappropriate for judges to write separately from time to time. They may want to expose a different line of reasoning or some nuance or different emphasis in the approach they take to the same result as is reached by a majority. The extent to which judges write together or separately, I think, will vary from time to time according to the personal chemistry, if you like, of the court. But at the moment, and for quite some time, I think we've had an essentially collegial approach, but it's not governed by rules or protocols. So when we have finished a case, we sit around in my chambers if I've been presiding, and we will discuss the case, and if a clear consensus emerges or a clear majority emerges, then I will suggest that one of the judges might like to write a first draft. It's just a suggestion. It's not a formal assignment as happens in the United States Supreme Court. That justice will write a first draft, and normally the other justices will wait until that first draft is done, and it's usually done fairly promptly. And then the first draft is circulated, and then if another justice agrees with the first draft, they might make some suggestions for alterations, they'll circulate a single-line concurrence. And then the judge who's written the first draft will ring up the other judge and say, can I join you? And then that becomes a joint judgment of the two of them. And sometimes you'll get a cascade of those concurrences so that you'll end up with a joint judgment, sometimes of everybody. Some people say, if you don't have enough joint judgments, it's hard for the profession and for everybody else to understand what the ratio is.
The underlying principle of the judgment.
The principle for which the decision is authority. Other people say, oh, if you have too many joint judgments, it reflects submerging your independence in compromise. So what I say is you can't please all of the people all the time. It's a balance. As long as you have an essentially collegial and cooperative approach, that's the important thing, and that's a matter of culture.
And there are different views about this because at one end of the spectrum, you have the now retired Justice Hayden, who said in an article in 2012 that even when you agree with your fellow judges, judges should still write their own reasons. He was concerned about judicial herd activity and artificial consensus among judges, and he felt that was a real danger. And he said, quote, compromise is alien to the process of doing justice according to law. And he was fearful that forceful personalities could weaken the resolve of individual judges. I mean, do you worry about the dangers of groupthink and dominant personalities?
Well, not on this court. I think everybody has a fairly healthy sense of their own independence. And when people agree, they agree with full intellectual assent. That's been my experience, certainly, of how my colleagues work. And the fact that some of them do write separately from time to time merely reaffirms that they don't join in routinely. I just don't see those risks reflected in the day-to-day realities of the court.
I'd like to ask you a
few questions about your life experience. Way back in, I think it's 1969, you stood as the Liberal candidate, I think, in the seat of Fremantle in Perth. You were an aspiring young politician and you thought a rock gig might be a good way to get the youth vote out in support of you. Can you just tell me what happened at that event?
Oh, there was a band, a rock band, which was supporting me. They would come around and play at shopping centres and on one occasion at Rottnest Island, which was actually part of the electorate of Fremantle. I think they were called the Timepiece. And the idea was they would come and play and I would hand out pamphlets and my supporters would do that. And we took them over to Rottnest Island on one occasion and my recollection is they were playing on the back of a truck not far from the Rottnest Hotel, and we called it Music Plus Manifestos. And there was quite a good-humoured crowd around the truck, and when the band played, they were wrapped. When the band stopped and I started to speak, they would move forward and start to rock the truck. So it was clear what they preferred.
They were rocking the truck to get you to shut up, to start the music again.
Yes, but it was a useful experience. One got a sense of the idea of how tough a politician's life can be. I mean, I was doing a lot of door knocking and engaging with a lot of interest groups, and I certainly became aware that people really didn't care what level of government was involved. They wanted solutions to particular problems, whether they were local government or state or Commonwealth. There was a segue between them.
You didn't win that election lost to politics and again to law, perhaps. Really interesting, though. You've tried, I guess, a few different things in your life. You actually started university. You studied science. When you graduated in science, you decided at that point to study law. You told a journalist once that this was a default position to keep your career options open. The law didn't grab you at that point.
No.
But at what point did it grab you?
Well, I studied law because I thought it offered me the greatest range of career choices, not confined to being a practicing lawyer. And at the end of the law degree, I secured articles with a small firm, and I then found myself engaged with real people, with real problems, which had potentially legal solutions. That was transformative, and my motivation and engagement and interest went up by orders of magnitude, and really, that's never changed.
You told a journalist once that your time when you started being a lawyer, where you really kind of got into it, you were dealing with drugs, drunks and prostitutes. So these were the real life people whose dilemmas and whose situations you felt you could kind of help or address.
Well, they were the kind of legal problems that I was dealing with. I didn't go out looking for them. They came through the door. There was a string of breathalyzer cases in which I got involved, and I got quite interested in the science of the breathalyzer. There was a lot of drug crime around at the time, as there has been ever since, and there were some cases there which raised some interesting technical questions. One I remember was about the botanical taxonomy of cannabis, which ended up in the High Court. We lost in the end, but it was a very interesting case.
So way back then, you're interested in science, and recently, Justice Gordon opened her speech at an event to celebrate your career. What do cannabis, sativa, Viagra, carcinogens, BRCA, BRCA1, which is in general terms the breast cancer gene, and Norwegian roll-on, roll-off container ships all have in common? The answer is Chief Justice Robert French, the judge and lover of science. I think she was kind of what she was referring to as perhaps the relish with which you jumped into cases involving these sorts of issues.
Yes, I'd never regretted having done the science degree. It introduced me to a methodology, to a culture, to a way of reasoning, which has its own inherent value in approaching legal problems. And, of course, there are many legal issues which intersect with scientific questions. And if you feel comfortable enough to understand, to approach a scientific article, for example, a paper, read the abstract, look at the summary, even if you can't really follow all of the substance of the article, you're ahead of the game a bit. And I found the scientific questions that have arisen from time to time inherently interesting. We've had some cases when I was on the federal court involving biotechnology, medical technology, the case about the breast cancer gene patentability issue, which was mentioned by Justice Gordon was fascinating because that, of course, dealt with, in part, how does the DNA molecule work. So there have been quite a number of cases where science and the determination of scientific questions and issues have been involved, and I have very much enjoyed those.
What are your plans when you step down from the bench?
I think, if I were to put it generically, it'd be writing, teaching and good works. I have been appointed as an adjunct professor at UWA and an honorary professor at ANU here in Canberra, so that these will be opportunities for me to explore in teaching, seminars or maybe projects that we can develop, explorations of legal issues that interest me, and particularly the law-science interaction.
Will you be speaking out publicly about issues close to your heart?
I don't think I will be engaging in public controversy or politically charged debates, but in the areas that I am interested in, I mean, they may involve some approaches to particular policy questions, particularly in the area of education and science education and so forth, and perhaps also some further activity in relation to Indigenous issues. But I would hope to approach those in a constructive way. And there are controversialists and public advocates for particular positions. There are other ways of doing those things too.
One final question. You're quite a physical guy. You ran the 2004 Rome Marathon in 4 hours and 7 minutes. Not bad. You've been into scuba diving. You've been into whitewater rafting, and you've even done a tandem skydive. How important is fitness and physical movement for you?
Well, I'm not obsessive about it, but I think physical fitness is important. And it's a matter of having the discipline to do it regularly. And my levels of discipline vary from time to time. The last marathon I did was in 2004, and you were very generous with the time. I think it was a bit longer than that, about 4.5 hours. But it's the fun of doing it rather than any competitive urge that led me to do it. I have this fantasy that I have one left in me, but on the other hand, it may be better not to tempt fate. I'm hoping that one of the things I'll be able to do post-judicially is to get a more regular regime. There's nothing quite as nice as jogging along in the morning on the Indian Ocean waterfront near where I live to go and get the papers and have a bit of music playing through the earphones. And so you get a bit of physical exercise, at least the minimum that seems to be suggested as necessary, and at the same time enjoy yourself. And it's really, it's got to be enjoyable.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you.
It is. Thank you.
Chief Justice French, it was a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That's it for the Law Report, both for this week and for 2016. From next Tuesday, we'll bring you some of our favourite programs from the past year. Next week, our first summer show, Rachel Carbonell looks at the legalities of using sound as a weapon. On behalf of myself and producer Anita Barrow, I do hope you have a relaxing and rejuvenating break. Talk to you next year with more law.